Once more under the breach, dear friends. Now let's close the wall up with our English stead. This is another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, and I understand why my dad says exciting so much now. It's exciting for me. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Jake McClure. Usually, Jeff McClure is my co-host and partner. He's also my father. He is recovering from a medical condition and will be doing a lot better in the near future. So if you wish him well, I would appreciate it. His email address is jeff@tpwc.com. Please let him know you're thinking about him. All right. So last hour, I said some things. I said I was going to talk about trade. Now, I'm going to do this. I've got a lot of research put together about the different economic packages that both candidates have out on the table in the presidential election. But I realized in the middle of all of this analysis that I was doing that there's a lot of ignorance about what a lot of it even means. So last hour I said I would talk about NAFTA. If you'd like to call in and join the conversation, the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. Okay. What is NAFTA? Well, in order to describe NAFTA, I'm going to have to go back in history even further than NAFTA. NAFTA came into existence in 1992. It was negotiated in 91. So it had two presidents involved in that negotiation. It had George H.W. Bush and it had Bill Clinton. Between the two of them, no changes were made by those presidents. The State Department and other items involved there developed the agreement. Okay, I said I was going to have to go back in history a bit further. Well, we can go back to the founding of the World Trade Organization. This is kind of a court that says, hey, you two have an agreement between each other to do trade in a certain way, and I don't think that's fair. I think it's fair. They have to do it based on agreements between the countries, and the countries have to be members of the World Trade Organization. That's a really complicated kind of concept, so let's go back even further. Let's go back to the late 1700s, middle of the last half century of the 1700s. And there were some groups of people that were struggling, that were really upset about some trade issues. So specifically I'm talking about the 13 colonies of the United States before they were the United States. And you'll remember some things from your history book. It's pretty fascinating here. One of the big events that were the precursors to the Revolutionary War was something called the Boston Tea Party. And the Boston Tea Party was a group of people that got dressed up in a very non-PC way, in today's opinion, and went and raided a British company's tea ship and dumped a bunch of tea into the water. Well, why'd they do that? Because of tariffs. Because of taxation on trade. That was in Boston. Boston, Bingtown, it was one of the first localized outside of a major country trade area. It's kind of a repeat of what happened in the Netherlands. This place that was developed just to go out and trade with people. Their whole purpose for existing as a group became trading with other people. And when the British, who were technically the same country as we were at the time, said that we had to pay this astronomical, and it's relative because the price on the tariff wasn't horrible, but it was a statement of you have to pay more than other British citizens because you're over there and you're doing other kinds of trade. There was no arbitration panel that would say that's unfair. There was no place to appeal except to a king who really wasn't interested in listening. The Parliament didn't want to hear Ben Franklin talk about it. This is the level that we're talking about, that no, you don't get a say in this because we're big Great Britain and we can put a tax on what you are buying from almost anyone because you're part of us. Okay, so if you think of that as one of the reasons for the founding of our country, free trade, you're going to be really close to the truth. There are a lot of pieces of truth there, but free trade is a big part of it. The reason why the 13 colonies combined was in large part for free trade. You know, the concept that the federal government regulates interstate commerce is part of our Constitution. And it says a state can't charge a tax just because it's coming from another state. That's a very clear part of the very basic fundamental idea of who we are as a nation. Trade. Because of that, we have a whole series of other laws that allow us to have the same property rights across the country in large part, at least as a basic fundamental foundation. If a state wants to go further, they can. But if you invent something in Idaho, someone in California can't use that thing you invented without your permission or without paying you money. That's free trade. It's regulated, which is the word free gets really weird there, but the concept of protecting intellectual property rights is part of that trade. You can't steal people's ideas and have free trade. The way that NAFTA was written after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had just collapsed, and was in like months before they were putting this thing together. And one of the things that we recognize as economists and the rest of the public recognized at the time, you know, we said we won the Cold War with rock and roll and with blue jeans. Well, that's true. The free market economics, the fact that we could all afford blue jeans, the fact that we could listen to rock and roll when we wanted to, was part of what caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. As soon as they started allowing other people in their country to recognize that we had this on a regular basis, things got complicated for the Soviet government. There were a lot of other factors, but that was one of the big emotional contexts to the collapse. The fact that you could earn money and keep it, the fact that you could trade with someone else and not have them steal it from you. That concept of free trade is purely American. It didn't exist in this manner at any other time in history, except maybe in the Russian Empire. But even then, the arbitrary movements of the emperor caused weird imbalances. We have a little bit of that, but not huge amounts. So back to NAFTA. In agreeing with Canada and with Mexico that we could import and export to them duty-free, that they could bring their stuff to us as if they were a state of the United States, and we could take our stuff to them as if they were a state of the United States, or we were a state of Mexico or a state in Canada. The fact that United States companies could manufacture parts in Mexico and put them together here was a profit booster. Now, did that cost jobs? In the auto manufacturing area, yes, absolutely, it cost jobs. But it brought the prices of cars down, and it delayed the bankruptcy of the big three automakers in the United States by decades. Because our manufacturing costs were not being run by the market anymore. There were contracts that were arbitrarily in place without considering competition set forth by the unions. That caused the prices of our automobiles to be much higher than it should have been. And we made up for that by buying parts from manufacturers in Mexico that had a lower labor cost. But last hour I spoke about tomatoes. Right now, if you go to the grocery store and you look at tomatoes, there are a lot of American tomatoes out there right now. There's also a lot of Mexican tomatoes out there. The Mexican tomatoes are a little bit more expensive than the American tomatoes. That's because they have further to travel. If you wait a few months, there aren't going to be that many American tomatoes. There's going to be a lot of Mexican and some Colombian tomatoes up there. I mean, you look at the little sticker, it'll say grown in Mexico. And the price that we pay for tomatoes is drastically lower today than it was before NAFTA. the price that we pay for automobiles is drastically lower than it was before NAFTA. Did it cost jobs? Yes. Did it make jobs? Yes. It made a lot more jobs than it lost. The fact that we can manufacture things here and send them somewhere else without having, and then to immediately compete on a level playing field, where, yeah, it's a little bit more expensive because we had to ship it there, but the quality of American merchandise is enough that it should beat out that price differential. And it has, and we see lots of companies that have done well doing that. Now, there's this big complaint that a lot of American companies, the big ones, Google, Apple, General Motors is one of them as well, though they're not talked about as much, GE, lots and lots of big companies that have offices overseas and that manufacture and sell things overseas, keep a lot of their money overseas so they don't have to bring it home and pay taxes on it. There's an imbalance in trade there. Apple and Google have both said repeatedly they would much rather reinvest that money in the United States than leave it overseas, because the educated job population, the people that are capable of doing the things that have gotten them where they are, resides vastly in the United States. The creativity on how to make profits does not reside in Paris. It doesn't reside in Dublin. It resides in the United States. We get to keep our profits, and it's something that we grow up knowing. We get to look and see, how do we do this? And while the barrier to entry as a small business person is pretty big now, there's a lot of bureaucracy. And boy, does that need to be fixed. It's still the best out of every other industrialized nation. So to come back in with the often quoted, democracy is the worst form of government that exists except for all the others. The United States has the greatest barriers to small business production except for everybody else. NAFTA allows that free flow of ideas, and it set forth penalties for when people break the agreement. If an item is invented in Texas and then it's cloned in Canada and somebody starts producing it in Canada for a profit, there's a very clear governing body made up of the major countries that want to see free trade going on here. So between Mexico, Canada, and the United States, it's very clear, because the rules say you can't do that. The arbitration will be very clear. There'll be a big fine against that Canadian firm, and then trade continues for the Texas firm. It removes cheating, not completely, but at least there are penalties. Rule of law rather than rule of person. When we're talking about applying free trade, it is the way we think. It is the thing that has made the United States the great nation that it is. The fact that we dominate the world in trade is directly resultant to the way we consider trade. If we renegotiate NAFTA, and this is a statement that I heard from the Trump campaign, but it could just as easily come from any side. It cracked me up. We want to renegotiate NAFTA and make it more equal for America. Okay. Anybody that's read Animal Farm out there? Some pigs are more equal than others. More equal does not mean equal anymore. Free trade needs to be free. It cannot benefit one side over another. Even if one side buys more from the other side, if we're buying more from Mexico at a cheaper price, then that's good on us, not bad on us. Yeah, it does put some boutique farmers out of business, but not really, because the farmers' markets are thriving. Yeah, it did move a lot of jobs to Mexico. But the jobs are coming back to the United States, but they're not coming back to people. They're coming back to machines. Robots are taking those jobs, because we've got to keep getting the labor costs low or you won't buy the product. You being the consumer. NAFTA is a direct representation of the founding of our nation. And it's been a Republican trait for a long time. And suddenly, this is one of those fascinating points in history when the parties are flipping. It's a very strange situation because free trade is about as conservative as you can possibly get fiscally. Free trade is one of the most basic conservative principles that's been around for forever, and now it's being held higher by the Democrats than by the Republicans. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another example of this. The reason why China's not involved in that negotiation is because they haven't agreed to the intellectual property bylaws, the side that says that if we invent it, you can't do it or there's going to be lots of fines against you. China's not ready for that yet. They will be at some point. They have to be at some point because their labor prices are going up. We're going to stop buying from them. Now, they've got a lot of people, but their demographic tidal wave is going to get older over time. And they've had that one-child policy. They just got rid of it last year, but it's a bit late. They're going to be upside down in their population. Right now, one grandchild has four grandparents in China on average. But each of those four grandparents have one grandchild on average. That's not good demographically. If we see a problem with Social Security here in the future, just think about what they're thinking about. They don't even have Social Security. There's no governmental backup there. There's no pre-idea of a tax surplus being used to pay for old age. So China as cheap labor goes away if we throw the tariff on there. How much do you want to pay for your next smartphone? Do you want to pay double what you have paid in the past? That's what happens if we put up the tariff. Because Apple doesn't have the manufacturing facilities in the United States to make iPhones, to make iPads. Samsung does not have manufacturing facilities in Korea to make Androids. So think about that for a minute. There's a huge investment cost that has to come in. And I'm going to use an example of something that's happened in the last 2 days. Volkswagen has a problem with some of its suppliers. This is a German automaker. It's the biggest automaker of Europe. It's going through some scandalous circumstances, but they're still profitable. They've had some hits to their share prices. They've had some hits to their production. The demand is down. People don't like it when they get lied to. Volkswagen, at the height of its popularity before the scandal, signed a contract with two of its suppliers, independent companies that supply gearboxes for transmissions and car seats, not child car seats, but the seats that actually go in the cars. And they signed this contract to make a lot more and different types of gearboxes and car seats. These two companies began immediately, and they're part of the same kind of parent company, they began immediately changing their manufacturing facilities. The contracts that were signed were worth about half a billion euros. That's a big deal for car part suppliers. It's a really, really big deal. These are not huge, huge, huge companies. Compared to Volkswagen, they're pretty tiny. Volkswagen, for no apparent reason, pulled out of that contract. The two companies went back to Volkswagen and said, hey, you pulled out of the contract. We've got a lot of money that we just put into redesigning our factories. You can't just pull out of the contract and have us eat this. Can you at least pay for what we've done already? Volkswagen said no. So the two part suppliers didn't deliver their parts. The gearboxes have stopped. The seats have stopped. The plants, there's one plant that's closed right now and another one that's possibly going to close. And in Germany, there's a backup to that because the second largest shareholder of Volkswagen is the German state. And the court has said to these auto suppliers, you must deliver your parts. They haven't delivered yet. So the next step is Volkswagen is going to go back to court and ask for the executives to be placed in prison or jail until they deliver the parts. But I think that everybody listening here sees a really, really big problem with that. If I'm a small business owner and somebody comes to me and says, here, I'm going to sign a contract with you to make a bunch of stuff over here. So start getting ready for that. The contract is ironclad. And I'm already doing business with you, so it's great. So you start making the changes, you spend your money, and then they come back and they say, and they rip up the contract in front of you, and you have no recourse because the government's involved. And so you say, well, I'm not going to deliver any of these other parts to you until you pay me the money that you owe me. And then the government says, well, you will, or you're going to go to prison. That's not free trade. It's part of the problem with the free trade agreement that we're having with Europe right now is that it's falling apart at the governmental level in each of the countries of Europe because they don't really understand free trade. They don't get the concept. It's possibly one of the silver linings of the Brexit, and that Britain may be able to enter into a free trade agreement with us relatively easily and quickly. That's not the case if the political rhetoric actually causes people's minds to change about what free trade is. Did the 13 colonies lose jobs by not charging tariffs to each other in trade? No. Maybe. Maybe some of the jobs went south. Maybe some of the jobs went north. But the overall price to the consumers went down, which makes it easier to start new businesses and make new jobs. One of the big fears that folks that are looking at the market that are interested in this stuff has is that if Donald Trump is elected and he does what he's planned, what he says he will do, by putting a tariff on the Chinese, and I'll give you the specifics of that. He's got a 7-point trade plan. First, pull out the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even though we're the ones that instigated it, even though we're the ones that got the other countries involved, and even though this follows a long-term nonpartisan policy that the United States has been following for a long time. Number two, trade negotiations. Renegotiate NAFTA. Renegotiate it so that America has a better deal. Well, that sounds great on the front end, but this has happened in the past. We can look at history. What happens when you take free trade and you say, I'm going to renegotiate it so that I get a better deal? Well, the other side starts slapping tariffs on their end too, and it has a nasty impact on both economies. And it doesn't even have that short-term spike of business where the United States suddenly is able to do something better because we can't manufacture stuff here quick enough to match the price increase over on the other side. If we put a tariff on an import, let's call it a widget, well, we still don't have the facility to make the widget at a comparable price to that tariff. So it's going to take us a while to build the facility. There's a lot of front-end investment. And by the time that's done, people are buying less of that widget because it's become more expensive. So we lose money, don't make money. The jobs that we think we're going to make don't actually ever happen. This is, and I wish it were as obvious as this intuitively, to say we're not exporting jobs the way we think we are. We are going lower price. And yes, on an individual level, if you lose your job because somebody else will do it for cheaper, it's not fun. Absolutely not fun. And we have some really cool systems in the United States that sometimes get used too much, but unemployment insurance kicks in. The companies that you've been working for have been paying an insurance to the government so that you get an income when you're not working anymore, while you're looking. And on average, in the worst possible time in our history, it took 9 weeks for somebody to find a new job. So we're not talking about huge numbers of people that didn't find jobs immediately. They existed, though. Let's not forget that they existed. Those are the stories that people bring up in the political rhetoric. He looked for a job for a huge amount of time and look at the number of kids he has and all of that. That's a real story, and it's really important to recognize that any time that there is an economic shift, it has consequences. And you have to measure the greater good against the consequences. generally speaking, I'm for individual rights over the whole, because everybody's an individual, and therefore everybody as a whole has individual rights. That's cool. And that means that the individual right of the company to hire or fire, based on how much they have to pay for labor, has to be part of our system. As soon as we say you can't fire someone, then the quality of the merchandise goes down. The quality of education goes down. If somebody has tenure at a college, they can't get fired. They can say whatever they want. They can start teaching witchcraft as the new form of science. They can do a lot of things. Recognizing that the individual right of an employer to only hire when they expect to make a profit and to get rid of somebody for not doing their job, even if it's expensive to do that, if we start messing with that, we start messing with the fundamental nature of profit. And all of us are aware of it. We know it. Let's not be what happened in Rome, where just because there are enough of us to vote more goodies for ourselves, that we stop thinking about the good of the nation. So when I look at the Trump plan, and I said I was going to get to these two plans, the Trump plan lowers taxes across the board, which is amazing. It's fantastic if you think about the impact on an individual company. But what's the purpose of taxes? And the purpose of taxes is to fund the government. The same people that want taxes lowered also want less debt. And unfortunately, Trump is talking about more spending, not less. If you lower taxes and increase spending, we're going to have more debt. That's a very simple concept that anybody can grasp immediately. If you're getting paid by your employer and they lower your pay, and they say it's a commission level, so you are going to have to make a lot more sales to get the same amount of pay at the same time that you increase your spending, you're going to put a lot of strain on your household. So taxes are kind of like commissions on sales. It's very similar to that. It's a commission on everybody's income. If you make more income, they make more money. If they raise their own commission level, you have to work harder to get the same amount of money. And if they lower their commission level, you don't have to work as hard to make the same amount of money. That's great. But what's the incentive? You just got a big raise because they've lowered your taxes. The things that you were working hard for before kind of slowly peter away. Now, people do want to make more money, but they don't make it as fast as that drop in taxes, at least at this point on the revenue curve. Now, the tax plan for Hillary Clinton, ugh, yuck. The same bad news there. There's a 4% surcharge on people making $5 million or more. There's a 30% minimum tax on $1 million or more being made. Let me tell you something about the 5 millions and the 1 millions. The very vast majority of people that make $5 million or even $1 million do it one time in their life. It is generally the sale of a business or the sale of property, something that they have spent their entire life earning. And the 1 year that it sells, they have this huge price tag to pay. And if you're talking about a minimum 30%, that doesn't include Social Security. It doesn't include self-employment taxes. We're talking about getting up close to a 50% tax. Not cool. She's proposing a 28% limit on deductions, getting rid of the carried interest. That both sides say that. Trump is in agreement with Hillary Clinton, saying that the carried interest loophole should be shut. It's not really a loophole. It was made intentionally. It's carried interest, for those of you that don't know what it is, which is most of us, I think. That's when, for instance, Warren Buffett gets paid based on his ownership in the company. So he'll sell some of his ownership, which is worth more, and the gain on that ownership is taxed at the capital gains rate. Well, that's the same way anybody else does it. So maybe putting a cap on it, both sides say they want to do that. I say if we want to do that, then let's make it less complex, not more. Both sides have talked about simplifying the code, but when I look at the proposals, all I see is more complexity. I see more complexity going in. Be aware of that. Now, what's the good news? It's highly unlikely that either party is going to get their tax plans passed. Congress does that. So back to last hour when I said, what was the last president who had a balanced budget? And people go, Bill Clinton, and they're either upset about that or they're happy about that, depending on their political alignment. And it's irrelevant because Bill Clinton didn't balance the budget. Congress balanced the budget. But Congress doesn't get the credit for it. Bill Clinton doesn't choose what to spend or what to save. Neither does Barack Obama or George W. Bush or any other president that we've had. They don't get that choice. It's not one that's on their responsibility list. It'd be nice if it was, but I think the rhetoric that's going back and forth about this is pretty interesting. Either way we look at it, no, neither party is going to win with a huge enough landslide for them to have the political capital necessary to force Congress to change the way the taxes are written. There might be some changes to the tax code, but I don't expect it to be that big a deal. So that was NAFTA, that was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that was some of the economic plans of the two parties. And I'm going to have to play some commercials because once more, Town Square needs to get paid. They need to pay the light bill and they need to make sure that we are on the air. So until we get back, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in and add your voice to the discussion, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. And I'll be back.
Hello?
Is your car still for sale?
And we're back. More of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake McClure. And I have a caller who called during the break and would like to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So, caller, you're on the
Hey,
air. Go ahead.
what do you say there, young man? You doing all right?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Well, I'm trying. I'm going to be doing all right if we can defeat this Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think that's probably one of the gravest dangers that we face right now.
Okay,
When it
what
comes
is it
to
about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that is a danger?
complete destruction of our sovereignty. There's 5,000 pages. They call it free trade, and the agreement is 5,000, over 5,000 pages. And they're calling that free trade. And in that, they have restrictions on our minimum wages. They have all kinds of things that are hid in there that will be regulated by not American government, but
Okay.
by the Trans-Pacific Partnership government, which is, we don't even have any idea who's going to be on that.
Okay. You're saying the 5,000 pages. This is a number that has been brought up by Donald Trump. He said 5,600 pages. I think that's the number that you're talking about.
Yes, it's over 5,000.
Okay. There's a problem with that number. And the problem with that number is that the negotiations right now include a lot of preliminaries that don't appear in the trade at the end. So just to cover the length, it's a complex, huge amount of paper right now. The reason why it's a complex and huge amount of paper is because we duplicate the same language for every country involved. It's kind of like when you get your instruction manual for a piece of electronic equipment or a chainsaw, and it's in nine languages. Well, it looks like you got a massive manual, but the part that's for you is a pretty thin part. Once it's finished, every one of those negotiations gets shortened. But you're right, it's long and it's complex. The part that's
And
long
it's
and complex about it isn't about getting rid of sovereignty. The fact is that in every free trade agreement that the United States has instigated and that we're part of right now, we've set the baseline for the regulations in the trade, and everybody else has to agree to it. So this is part of, you know, and I recognize that Donald Trump has said that this is a big danger, but understanding what it is first. Okay, what is sovereignty? The sovereignty that you're talking about that we would be giving up would be the ability for the United States government to say that something from Taiwan or something from the Philippines needs to be more expensive than something from Thailand. Is that a sovereign thing? Yeah, it's the ability to tax something. Now, we can step out of that agreement at any point. You know, if the Congress says we're out of here, this isn't a treaty. This is why it's called partnership or agreement, NAFTA. Because if it were a treaty, it would be something that a supermajority of the Senate would have to approve and the president would have to sign. All it takes is a majority of Congress and a signature from the president to get rid of NAFTA. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is an agreement to say, hey, you don't put any tariffs on us, we don't put any tariffs on you, but underneath it all, what is a trade? That definition, this is where, when people say it's not free trade if it's regulated, the only kind of free trade that exists is regulated trade. If you go down to true total free trade, what you're talking about suddenly is buying the watch from the guy who's got it hanging on the inside of his trench coat. That's true free trade. There's no taxes on it. You don't know the quality of the item you're buying. You don't know if the manufacturer is the correct manufacturer. It's going to a Chinese market in China. That's true free trade. There's no protection for the person who invented the item in true free trade. So real free trade, one that's protecting creativity, protecting the rights of the people that created the thing, is regulated trade. And when we talk about that, we say in the United States, we have regulated trade. If you buy something and sell it, somebody's going to be able to say, hey, you cheated me. There's a regulation that has to be there. And I'm very anti-over-regulation. So, caller, I'm in the same boat with you there. If the government's putting a bunch of regulations that don't make any sense on something, it's a travesty. But you and I probably both agree that there should be laws against murder, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
murder's a good regulation to have. Don't do that. And some people do it anyway. Well, we have rules that we follow to say when somebody murders, here's the process that we follow to make sure that they get stuck away and hopefully don't do it again. And in some places, that leads to the execution of the murderer. In some places, it leads to long-term prison time. In other cases, it leads to really stupid sentences. Well, we have to make those regulations better, and we all recognize that some regulations are important. If you go to a car dealership in Texas and you buy a car, sales guy says it's great, it's got 30,000 miles, you've got everything's functional, it's amazing, it's only had one odor, and you get home, and on the way home you notice that the odometer's not moving, the miles are not updating. And you get home and you look under the dashboard and you see that those wires aren't connected, that the odometer isn't moving for a reason. And then you take it back to the used car dealership and you say the odometer's not working. In the state of Texas, there's a lemon law, Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. That means that you get 3 times damages plus attorney's fees for that kind of fraud. Is that,
you know,
free trade?
The thing about it is the people that enforce that law, that lemon law, are Texans.
That's correct.
They're Americans.
That's correct.
They're not some supranational organization that we don't even know who it is.
Well, we do. That's something we do know. On the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the United States holds the chair.
I've never voted for NAFTA representative.
Well, you never voted for the head of the FBI either.
No.
This is not a pure democracy. This is a republic. That's why the Republican Party exists, because we elect people who appoint people. We elect people to read laws for us. If we forget that this is a republic as well, then we go down the path of Twitter runs everything. That's pure democracy right there. Just like pure free trade is a Chinese market where you don't know what you're buying and whether it's going to work and if the people that made it are the people that's printed on there. Some amount of regulation is necessary. And the last couple of weeks I talked at great length about when we go too far. And there's lots of places where we've gone too far. But we don't even know what's
left on PPP.
And you could say that. The regulation that existed before NAFTA on trade between Canada and Mexico and us was a lot more regulated than it was after NAFTA. The trade that exists between each of the countries that are involved in the TPP, if you're going to stack up the number of tariffs, the number of differences in trade law, you're talking about 20 times that much regulation. And that's at the most that TPP has gotten. So the number being thrown about of the 5,600 needs to be compared to the number that exists in the regulated trade between all those countries right now. And that number is much bigger. TPP is a simplification, not a complication. And that's really, really hard. And Donald Trump is approaching trade because there's a group of people in politics that have been in politics for a long time that are in large part represented in unions, which is a much more... And the union comes from communion, as in communist, the people-run organization. What we're seeing is a switch in the Conservative Party in their viewpoint of trade and their viewpoint of fair share. So keep that in mind. This is something that I have to remind Republicans. I've been reminding Democrats for a long time, but I have to remind Republicans. If you've been a conservative your entire life, have you been a conservative your entire life? Okay. Ronald Reagan, I would say, is one of, in most of our lifetimes, the most revered conservative president in our lifetime. Would you agree with that?
In my lifetime.
Okay. He was so behind NAFTA. He was so 100% in support of it that it's the reason why it exists. Ronald Reagan's idea on free trade, look that up. The conservative values that we hold today are not the conservative values of Ronald Reagan. Hold that in your mind. When Donald Trump is talking anti-free trade, anti-NAFTA, the big supporters of NAFTA were the Republican Party for a reason. Because it's scary, and it's something that happens regularly in our history. You need to study history. If you, one of the great places for you to look is look at what happened, the destruction of the Whig Party, or the creation of the Democratic Party, or the Republican Party. Andrew Jackson was running as a third party and developed the Democrat Party. Abraham Lincoln founded the Republican Party because the conservatives of the time were different than the conservatives before. Our parties change over time. We still call Republicans conservative, even though prior conservative values were family values. Trump's on his third wife. Not that that's a bad thing, because it represents a lot of what's going on in the country. But if you don't recognize that there's been a shift, then you can't make a good judgment. It isn't like being a Methodist or a Baptist, where you get to be a Baptist and you know what Baptists believe and it doesn't really change over your lifetime. Being a Republican or being a Democrat is not a religion. There isn't a final book that says this is what Republicans are, this is what Democrats are. And that's part of the reason, and I said this the last few weeks as well, the Democrats are now a larger party than the Republicans. And just about 10 years ago, that was not the case. It was the other way around. But the more important news is that the non-affiliated people is now larger than any party. People are feeling left behind because conservative values during Ronald Reagan, which most conservatives that have been conservatives a long time can look at that and say, yeah, that's what I believe, are not the same conservative values of today. Ronald Reagan is chided now for his amnesty deal with illegal immigration. But the support that he had at the time was very high, because we want to have a good partnership with our neighbors. We don't want to insult our largest trading partners. And the reality is that China is not our largest trading partner, not even close. The two that are our largest trade partner flip back and forth, but it's Canada and Mexico. We don't want to get them angry with us. We don't want to be angry with them. The best way to have a relationship is to start to share the same values, and that those values are codified in the agreements that we have on trade. If you use child labor, you get penalties. If you know, the things that we've agreed are ethical and good things in trade in our country are what we're putting in the agreements for trade that we have with TPP or with NAFTA. And when I remind people about Ronald Reagan's beliefs, when I remind people about that, there's a big shift that's going on. We're living in an amazing time where we're seeing some portions of conservatism switching over to the Democrat Party and some portions of liberalism switching over to the Republican Party. Donald Trump began a speech that was just played in the break that said, and it's his new slogan, it has to do with change. Are you afraid of change? That's a liberal statement. Conservative means to go back to what we had. Liberalism is to try something new. And this is a shift that we see regularly in history, but it's long enough apart that we're not alive to see two of them. So recognize that that's happening. And I'm about out of time. If you'd like to contact me off the air, it's jake@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can call me and get voicemail or real live people during the week, 947-1111 or 1-800-914-PLAN. You can go to the webpage, tpwc.com. Until next week.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central.